Hi, this is Bjarne Goldbeck. You are listening to the Fulham Focus podcast.
Four days, two away games, six goals conceded, and just 1 point gained. If there was a resurrection at Sheffield United, then our defence was crucified in the first half at Forest. Kish Courier and Stuart Lutz are with me to make sense of two games that were at best shambolically entertaining and at worst an absolute disgrace. We'll also be chatting night games, numbers and Newcastle. I'm Sam Diamond and this is Fulham Focus. Hello and welcome to a rather miserable Fulham Focus. Thankfully, I'm in fine company for this episode because back to join me again is arguably the only tolerable tactico on Twitter. It's Kish Courier, better known to the Fulham faithful as Cottage Tactico. Welcome back, Kish.
Thanks for having me. Wish it was in better circumstances, but here we go.
And making his first appearance on the show, hoping that his Fulham debut is more Joao Palhinha than Johan Mollo, he's the voice of H3. It's Mr. Stuart Lutz. Welcome to you, sir.
Hello. Welcome to me. Yeah, no, thank you. That was absolutely awful. I'm going to go again. thanks for having me on. I don't want a bad word said about Johan Mollo for the rest of the podcast.
I can't promise that.
Yeah. But yeah, no, it's a pleasure to be on, just unfortunately in such terrible circumstances.
Yeah, absolutely. So now, normally I would ask you both how you are, because manners cost nothing after all, but we are recording this straight after the final whistle at the City Ground, and I suspect what we've seen over the past couple of hours has had a huge bearing on both your moods. So let's dive straight in. Stuart, what are your immediate thoughts following tonight's shambolic showing?
My immediate thoughts are I'm gutted for the people that are going to be travelling back from Nottingham to London tonight, because it's been me on many an occasion and it is absolutely horrible. That was just, I don't think I've got many positive words to say in relation to the performance. I'm gutted for the fans that were there. I'm gutted being at home watching it, let alone having to travel home.
Yeah, Kish, are you of a similar feeling there, or have you been busy looking for some positives?
Look, I'll try and find some positives a bit later. I think we're all going to start feeling a little bit down in the dumps. I mean, I think what was said about the poor fans who are now probably on their cold walk back to a train station up in Nottingham. I mean, a horrible night up there for them. I think there have been some signs that it were coming. I know we all got very excited by the turnaround at the weekend at Sheffield United, but our away form has been poor for a very long time. And this was sort of the realisation moment, I think, that we have a real, real problem. And I think that the key now is to try and make sure that this isn't a problem for the rest of the season, not just away from home, but at home as well. Because there was a tiny bit of on the beach about the team tonight. I hope it was a bad night rather than a night that suggests they don't really care anymore for the rest of the season. But it's a real danger when teams get into that place. And I'm just really hoping that there aren't lots more nights like this for fans who are, particularly those who are travelling away, unlike us sat in our nice warm houses, ready to do this pod.
Yeah, I think we're right to mention the fans. It's funny because Nottingham Forest away last season, it was another midweek game. And it was one of the best away days of the season, right up there with Brighton. And it was sort of a very similar kind of feel tonight. In fact, that we went 1-0 down in the first half, and there was this hope of this second half recovery, but it never materialized. I mean, we'd normally look at sort of the team news, but I think maybe should we gloss over the team news and then just talk about, I think, the moment that really caught everyone's attention was Marco Silva's triple substitution just after the half hour mark. I mean, I've never seen anything like that from a Fulham manager before. It's shades of Jose Mourinho at his finest. Kish, what did you make of it?
I mean, I absolutely loved it. Not least because I think we're all in the sort of Fulham focused WhatsApp groups and saying, sub X, so-and-so needs to wake up, get X off. And the thing that really was the hardest thing for Marco was to design which three. And I think maybe we can get into that a little bit later when we start thinking about what went wrong and what maybe went slightly more right for a bit of the game. But look, Marco's spoken in the past about the influence Jose Mourinho has had on him as a Portuguese manager. I was glad that he got his moment to go full Jose because I think it was justified. I also think it shows how confident he is in his position at Fulham, how much respect he feels he has from the team that he felt he could do that. You know, managers with less authority in a dressing room can't make a move like that. They might try and do it and it'll backfire horribly. And he felt like he could. And I think that's credit to the job that he's done. I think there were some tactical issues tonight that we might get to, but I don't think many Fulham fans are blaming Marco for where we currently are, particularly away from home. I think there's some questions to be asked about some of those players, and including those who were hooked early.
I mean, it was an incredibly sluggish start, kind of, you know, continued from where we left off at Sheffield United. It was only the second time this season that we conceded a goal in the opening 15 minutes of a Premier League game. It's something where we've looked, you know, quite solid, really, this season. It seemed like Nottingham Forest caught us by surprise. Stuart, did that, the way we began this game, did that catch you by surprise?
Honestly, no, because I've seen it coming. As Kish said, it's been coming. A performance like this and a performance like we saw on the weekend, which was papered over by Rodrigo scoring a bicycle Scorpio scissor kick, sublime. Performances like this have been in the knocking for a while. And when, as soon as Hudson-Odoi broke, I knew that was going in. And I knew what night that we had in store for us, because I've seen it happening at the Cottage. I've seen it coming. I don't know what on earth happened against Spurs. I don't know how that happened, but yeah, I've seen this performance coming in the distance for some time. To talk about Marco's subs, I'm a massive fan of them. I'm glad he did them. As soon as we went 1-0 down, I thought, okay, maybe a sub at halftime to freshen things up a little bit, get a different style of play, someone that can control the ball in the midfield a bit more with Tom Kearney coming on, perhaps. But when we went 2-0 down, I was just delighted that he'd taken three players off and just tried something new. I was trying to rack my brain for the last time I could think of a Fulham manager doing something like that. And the only thing I've been able to come up with was Ragnar Sigurdsson in the Championship when Slav Jokanovic hooked him off after about 13 minutes. And it was needed then, it was needed today. So yeah, I don't blame Marco for what happened today, personally. I quite like the direction that he tried to move the team into once we'd gone 2-0 down. It's yeah, just individual performances, I think, that have let us down overall, which I'm sure we'll get into.
Yeah, and look, if we look at those subs sort of one by one, I think Sasa Lukic, who's been getting a lot of plaudits recently for how he's looked coming into that central midfield position, I think the desire to get sort of TC on and try and control the game was just massive, and that's why he got the hook. I thought he had a poor start to the game, Lukic, but I think a lot of people did. I don't think he stood out particularly, but I understood why Kearney made sense. I think Willian was an essential for Marco in terms of trying to control the game, and he doesn't really trust anyone else in terms of getting on the ball and slowing it down and getting a grip of things. And I understood why he came on. I probably would have taken Harry Wilson off for Willian, and sort of, I don't think anybody really noticed Wilson was there for the first 20 minutes, which isn't necessarily his fault. He's an attacking player, but I get that one. The one that slightly surprised me was Alex Iwobi. Not because he wasn't playing poorly. I think he'd given the ball away quite a few times and was looking like he was struggling. But he's a massive favourite of Marco. He's been in good form since signing for the club. And I thought it was an interesting move that he was the one who got the hook. And particularly that the defence stayed as it was. I mean, we looked awful defensively in that first 20 minutes. We didn't really get a lot better. I think we're going to have to talk about Kenny Tete at some point, who I'm sure a lot of fans were quite excited to see come back into the team. I know he's a fan favourite, but I mean, how that defence managed to avoid the triple substitution and how that defence managed to play a full 90, I don't really know, other than the fact that there were other subs that needed to be made, but it's sort of astonishing.
It very much was that cliche of any one of them could have been pulled off when he made those subs. So if we are unanimous in praising Marco for making those changes so early, do we then have to be slightly critical of the starting lineup that he named?
Yeah, I think we do. Just yeah, in turn, we should have to be. I understand what Kish was just saying about many people looking forward to Kenny Tete coming back in. As soon as I saw him on the team sheet, I wasn't. I'm not entirely sure why he needed to be starting the game. I don't know whether Castagna was just, I don't know whether he was fatigued or something, but if he was fatigued, that would lead me to believe that he shouldn't have even been on the bench. I don't think that was the right defensive lineup to put out, especially when you know that they've spent about 5 billion on 500 attacking players.
So, Kish, you posted your expected 11 on social media this morning, and I think yet again you ended up being one player out. So you obviously had a feeling for it, but I know you had thoughts in terms of the fullbacks up against Alanga and Hudson-Odoi. Can you talk to us more about that?
Yeah, look, so the one that I got hooked by was the Fulham admin posted a picture of Bobby Reid this morning. So I was like, he's going to start. He didn't start. It was Harry Wilson, although he didn't really play for very long. So I guess Bobby had more of a run out in the end. But otherwise, it was as I expected. I just had a feeling that we were going to give Castagna a rest. And given that Tete sort of came on and did all right at the weekend, that Marco would give him a go. I think it's quite hard when you've got players like Tete who have been a big part of the team previously, have been really, really good at times previously, and suddenly they're out of form, out of the side, sometimes can't even get on the bench. I think managing that from sort of a human side is quite difficult. And we don't know what personalities are like. We don't know whether some people get very down when they're not playing or how they respond to it. So I just thought that this was a game in which Marco would say, Kenny, on you come. And my anticipation before the game was that he'd be up against Anthony Alanga. I mean, thank God he wasn't. I mean, he was up against Callum Hudson-Odoi, who he made look sort of faster than Alanga and Adama Traore put together.
He was running in quicksand or treacle at like many points in that game. It was incredible.
Yeah, I always make a point, including on Twitter, that I try not to just sort of bag on players too much because sort of that's not really what I want to do. But I'm sorry, we're going to have to talk about Kenny's performance because it was a bizarre performance.
We have to talk about Kenny.
We have to talk about Kenny because, I mean, and the reason I said I thought fans were excited for him to come back in is that I think one of the questions I get the most online is, why do we keep picking Castagna? Why do you keep on putting Castagna in your preferred lineups? Why does Marco love Castagna so much? And I've talked a bit previously about sort of the role that Castagna plays and how it's slightly different to what we were doing last season, whatever. But also he's been really solid. And I think the negative side of that is that I think that fans' perceptions of where Kenny is currently versus, you know, what he actually is at the moment as a player are very, very out of sync. So a lot of people remember sort of those swashbuckling performances against Chelsea and the like last year. He's been nowhere near that for a while. He's been making mistakes every time he comes into the side. I mean, he ruined Boxing Day, quite frankly. and so I've been sort of saying to people online that there's a reason that Castagna keeps on playing. There's a reason that Kenny can't get a game. So the excitement, I think, was there from some people. But I, like Stuart, was a bit worried. I just thought that was the way Marco was going to go. And it didn't really go very well, I don't think.
Can't believe Kenny Tete ruined your Boxing Day when usually it's the in-laws. So.
I love the in-laws.
Can they play right back?
They might have to if Castagna is as tired as it seems. He didn't even come on. So, I mean, there really must have been something there, I think. I think Stuart's right.
Stuart, Kish says he doesn't like to dig out players. Where I haven't had a season ticket next to you for some years. I think you do. Is there anyone else you would like to isolate for special attention here?
So you and everyone in H3 knows how I feel at the best of times about tossing Adebayo. And I don't understand what he does. I don't understand how the likes of United, AC Milan, Monaco, I don't understand how they're getting linked with him and how he seems to be holding these, all the bargaining chips, saying, oh no, I might not sign, and oh no, I'm pretty much a level above this. I don't think he's at the level that we're playing at. I don't think he's been at that level since we took the step up into the Premier League. And I think he's prone to about 7 or 8 disastrous mistakes a game that could lead to opposition goals. I think Kenny was, unfortunately for him, the for us, the worst player on the pitch tonight. But a couple of those goals came simply looking at just those, their positioning as a right-sided central back and a right fullback, looking at them and how they should be synced up together. They just weren't. It seemed as though neither of them kind of knew what was to be expected of them. And yeah, I don't know. I don't want my debut on this podcast to be going on and on about the fragility that I see in Tosin and Tete, but I struggle to look past it after what I saw tonight.
I mean, on Tosin, sorry, just I think the reason he's getting linked with clubs that he is that the kind of player he is the kind of centre-half that clubs want, right? So he's massive, he's fairly quick, he's sort of composed on the ball. Like when you're sort of building like what you want a centre-half to be at sort of elite clubs, it's something that looks a bit like Tosin, but more consistent than him. So people kind of talk themselves into the idea of it. I think he makes a lot of sense for a club like Fulham. I'd probably defend him a bit from sort of the 7 or 8 mistakes a game. And I understand his role on the side, but I do think that some of the links have been ambitious. And I think it's because teams are sort of looking at him as something that might make sense rather than as the finished article. But yeah, it was that right-hand side that looked dodgy to me, and the connection between them was rough. And I also just think it comes a little bit to the tactics of things that we might get onto in a minute, that Kenny was really high up the field. He was bombing on in the same way Anthony Robinson would, but he hasn't got the gas to get back, and he didn't have any cover behind him. So that seemed like a little bit of a problem area for us.
That's just one thing I'd like to touch on as well, is Anthony Robinson. I don't know what has happened to him or what Marco has done to him since the Championship to the Premier League, but he was one of the only players tonight that I was actually happy to watch. I thought he put a shift in, and he's done it every game that I've seen him play this season. Yes, he still moves a bit like a giraffe, finding out how to use his legs every now and then, but he's been absolutely fantastic. I think he's been night and day since Marco's kind of taken him under his wing a little bit. So if there is one positive from today that I'm taking, it's Anthony Robinson.
Yeah, I thought he played very well, and he certainly has been one of the success stories of Marco and his coaching team. I remember being at Coventry with you a couple of years back and watching a performance almost on par with tonight in terms of just being an absolute disgrace from a defensive point of view. And he was a major culprit. But yeah, he has come on leaps and bounds. And yeah, as you say, I thought he was very good. Looking at Tete and Tosin then as a pair, to continue with that, both of those players are out of contract this summer. What do we see? Where do their futures lie? Obviously, Tosin, there's been a lot of speculation about he's unlikely to sign a contract, and he has these supposed suitors. Fulham were reportedly up in their contract offer to him for a new deal. I guess performances like tonight aren't going to help that. But do we see these players in Marco Silva's Fulham squad for the 2024-25 season?
I think the worry from watching tonight is that fans will quickly think both of them had an eye on their next club with the way that they played today. And that is a very worrying place to be in. I think
all clubs have an eye on them though after tonight.
Yeah, exactly. Well,
that is the question. So I think I think Kenny's gone. I really think he's gone, just because I don't think he's a player that seems to respond that well to competition. I don't think he likes sitting on the bench. I think Castagne has been very, very good, and I think he sees what Marco wants from a right back. So I think Kenny's long gone. And I think we'll get nothing like the money we would have got for him last summer. But I think that's one that we're going to have to take on the chin. Tosin, I really don't know. I think he makes a lot of sense for what we do. I'm sort of slightly higher on him than Stuart, I think. I wonder if scouts would have had a look, and the likes of Man United and AC Milan might have taken a second thought as to whether he really makes sense for them. And the worry I'd have if I was Tosin is that I think that a lot of the clubs that he thinks he should be playing for, he'll sit on the bench for. And I don't know if that's really what he wants.
Although that never really seems to be in players' minds in these circumstances, because we've seen it so many times with good Fulham players in the past.
Entirely true. And look, maybe he's at a stage of his career where he thinks he's going to take that gamble and see what happens. So I think that's one that could rumble on a bit this summer. But I think Kenny's long gone, I'm afraid.
Well, let's talk tactics then. In terms of tonight's showing, and let's bring in Saturday's draw at Sheffield United into the equation as well. Kish, I'm happy for you to lead us here with your expertise and know-how. Tell us what you made of almost 200 minutes of very bizarre football in 4 days.
Yeah, I think the weekend was, I mean, tonight was pretty bonkers. I mean, the second half felt like the last 10 minutes of a cup tie for the entire second half. But I thought the weekend was an absolutely mad match. That second half there was truly ridiculous. And sort of, I think it slightly defied reasonable analysis at points. There was sort of just some things happening, which is kind of what football's meant to be about. It's not all about sort of systems and data and nerdy things. But I think a couple of things that struck me, one is that I don't know what's happened to Fulham's defensive midfield, sort of solidity and partnership and structure. João Palhinha seems to be playing really high up the pitch, and he seems to be used primarily to try and win the ball back high and sustain our attacks than how he was used last season, which was to sort of screen and fill holes as we bomb players on. And Marco always sort of wants that other midfielder to sort of push on a bit, whether it's Lukic or Tom Kearney or whoever, even Harrison Reed does it. And I think what we've ended up with is sort of this gaping hole in the middle of the park that seems to sort of leave us open time and time again. And that's been a real worry just to watch. And it felt like it was a big factor tonight as well.
Yeah, no, just on that, I just had a question for you on the back of it, Kish. Do you think that Lukic coming in and doing as well as he did when he first came into this team has in part played into us looking so fragile in defensive midfield? Because it seems as though Marco knew what he wanted to do with the three that we were playing, with Harrison Reed as a more advanced defensive midfielder, João Palhinha to sit in there and fill the gap when a centre-back would move forward, and Andreas to try and link the attack and midfield together. It seemed as though he really had cohesiveness with those three. But since Lukic has come in due to injuries and red cards and whatnot, and he's done well, it seems as though that's given Marco kind of a bit of a quandary, because he doesn't want to take him out because he's playing well, but it is also potentially playing into the fact that we do look a bit more fragile there.
Yeah, I think that's partly true. And I think probably not because Sasa Lukic has played poorly or has been defective himself, but just that balance aside from the Tottenham game, which everybody was fantastic in, that balance just doesn't seem quite there. There seems to be less of an understanding of when one goes and when one sits. I think Sasa Lukic has been playing really high himself. I don't think it really suits him to be that high. I've enjoyed seeing him sort of have a bit more license to get forward. I thought he did it well against Spurs, but I think in the last two games, he's sort of been playing as like the same way Andreas would. And that seems sort of slightly backwards. So I do think there's a sort of a question mark for how Marco manages that. And I'm surprised that he didn't ask sort of Palhinha just to sit sooner tonight. Because I think he did a little bit when Tom Kearney came on, and that seemed to sort of solidify us a bit. But yeah, that I think is a worry. And I think it's something that he's going to have a real think about who that midfield two is by the time we get to the weekend. And maybe we'll come on to that a bit later. The other thing I wanted to mention, though, is that just having a look. So one of the questions I've been asked a lot recently is that Fulham are obviously really bad away from home. Why are they so bad away from home? We've had some really fun suggestions. So Jim Kessel on Twitter, Fulham Random, it's a great account on Twitter. If you don't follow that, do have a look. Have been suggesting sort of reasons why we're bad. One of which is the black kit. This black and pink kit seems entirely cursed. We never win anything with it on, but we wore the white tonight, so it's not down to that. It's also been pointed out that we seem to be doing very bad under the lights away from home. Hasn't been suiting us well at all. But I wanted to look at
that's a real worry for games sort of play throughout the winter.
Yeah, exactly that. But you know, one of the things I wanted to look at were like the actual metrics, like the stuff that underlies like what other teams are doing, what you're doing. Sometimes people think that Fulham are quite bad when they have more of the ball because they sort of get stale and stuck. So I did a load of data analysis on that, which I'll post in a couple of days. And like, basically, the problem is that we also tend to have very little of the ball against really good teams, and those really good teams tend to beat us. So it makes the numbers go crazy. But if you just look at the teams that we in and around us that we should be beating, we struggle against them when we have lots of the ball because they can set off and sort of sit and block us. And that kind of has been happening in the last couple of games. So in the last two games, we've had over 65% of the ball, and we haven't won either of them. And in fact, I think there's been five games where we've had that much possession. We've only won one, and that was Luton at home, and we were quite lucky to win it. So I think there is something in the idea that when you give Fulham lots of ball and sit off them, we don't really have the tools to break teams down, and that can lead to big problems away from home.
I did wonder how much of tonight's possession statistic was skewered by the fact that we were starting the second half 3-0 down and they were quite happy to sit on what they had. But looking at this now, it does seem as though we had 63% of the ball in the first half as well. So there's definitely something in that.
Yeah, and look, I think what you say about the situation matters, right? So, and the problem we have is that we keep on making errors. So we keep on giving teams a goal, and then they can sit off, and they really can sit off because they've got something to fight for, and it becomes even harder. So we struggle when teams do that anyway. If you make a couple of silly errors or give away a goal from a set piece or give away a penalty or do lots of the daft things we keep on doing away from home, it then makes that job even harder. And I think part of what we need to work out is why we seem to make those errors away from home as well. And unfortunately, I think that comes down partly to mentality. That's not a tactical thing all the time. Sometimes it can just be players being a bit wobbly and struggling a bit. And I don't know if you guys feel that's something that's fair to level at this Fulham side, but we seem a little bit soft.
I mean, we're no strangers to this, though, are we? I can think of many Premier League seasons where our away record has been even worse than this one. It's just, I don't know what it is. I often used to think it was psychological. Did we take small away support to places and get easily turned over? I don't think that's necessarily the case now, but it does seem to be an issue this season. I was just looking. We won 72% of our points this season at home. I think of all the teams in the Premier League, only Newcastle, funnily enough, who we play next, have a higher ratio of points won at home. So I guess it's something to work on, but how is the pivotal question? It's also annoying because I only really go to away games at the moment.
Oh, mate, that's not the way to be at the moment. That's a painful one. I mean, the last away game I went to was Old Trafford. So,
all right, mate, don't rub it in.
Maybe I need to pitch up again.
Didn't get to that one. I was at Wolves. So the joy brought about by that late comeback at Sheffield United seems a very long time ago now. But Stuart, your dad, friend of the show, Stuart Luce Sr., he was at Bramall Lane on Saturday. He must have enjoyed Rodrigo Muniz's spectacular scissor kick equaliser.
Oh, you would have hoped he would have. You would have hoped he would have. Were he to have stayed for it, I'm sure he would have. I will give one shout out to the what seemed to be the Nottingham Forest commentary team that were working for TNT tonight, because I'm sure my dad would be very annoyed at me for not mentioning an absolute belting line of Wood coming alive in the box. So we'll give that a big shout out today. But yeah, no, he... I don't actually feel sorry for him, and I'm sure that he doesn't feel sorry for himself either. He made the decision, I'm sure a lot of people would have, when that fourth went in.
It's a spectacular Fulham line, isn't it? That we went 4-1 down, all our fans left at 4-1 down, and we managed to draw 3-0.
Yeah. I was on the motorway when it happened, and I saw the messages pop up on my car, and I saw that he'd left, and I was listening to Talksport as it happened, and yeah, the commentator came over the radio and said that Fulham had gone 4-1 down, and then a minute later said that it was 3-2, and I nearly crashed my car. I didn't know what was going on. I'm sure he's watched it many times since getting home.
My dad was always one for leaving games early as well, and I always used to berate him for it. It must be a dad thing. I'm sure I'll be doing the same with my son eventually. I haven't really got much more to say on these games. Which was your favourite of the three goals we conceded tonight? I particularly enjoyed the one where Chris Wood passed it into the net from 25 yards as Bernd Leno did his stumbling out of a pub drunk walk across his 6-yard box. Or not even his 6-yard box, 18-yard box.
I can't actually recall who was to blame for that goal, but I actually weirdly wasn't even annoyed whatsoever when that hit the back of the net, because I actually thought it was quite a clever finish from him. I thought it was really clever. And it's just... the less I can say about tonight, the better, because I'd rather not be going to prison for a public order offence on my debut of the podcast.
I feel like we've given you a really tough one to start with. So my first pod, I was the newbie, right? My first pod, we just won 5-0. It was lovely. I came on and talked about how good everything was.
Was that the first 5-0 or the second 5-0?
It was the second 5-0. Yeah. Like, everyone was so happy. Yeah. And like, you've got to come on and try and defend the indefensible. I mean, it's as far as pod debuts go, we're asking for a lot, to be fair.
I mean, talking of the 5-0s, obviously one was against Nottingham Forest at Cottage earlier in the season. Yeah. But I did really worry we were going to end up losing this season on aggregate at one point. I thought they're gonna get 6 or 7 here, and that 5-0 is going to seem even longer ago than it is. yeah, actually, it's on the substitutions. I've just seen this, so I'll say it. Opta have just posted that Fulham's free substitutes in the 33rd minute is the second earliest a side has made free subs in a Premier League game after Stoke against Sunderland in the 30th minute back in February 2009.
And to be fair to Marco, he was ready on about 27
minutes.
He would have had if the ball had gone out of play, he'd have had the record. He was fuming. Look, if we're going to talk about sort of moments from this game, let's not talk too much about the goals, which were us being asleep. I mean, let's not focus on those. The moment that I found incredible, other than the subs, was the shot of Marco Silva after half time, sat on the bench, looking like he wanted to cry. I mean, he looked absolutely shattered. And I mean, I wish I cared that much about something that fundamentally didn't matter that much. Like, we're safe. He's done a wonderful job. The game had probably gone. He looked heartbroken. And I just think that it is a testament to the sort of how much he loves to win that he clearly was taking that one very, very hard. And I think the players are going to be made to know about it in the next couple of days. And I think it's a big question now what we see come Saturday, because it will tell us how invested they are in playing for him, how invested they are in the rest of the season, and what we can really look forward to before it all closes down for Euro 24. So, yeah, poor Marco.
Absolutely. Although, mind you, if you'd had a shot of me on my sofa during that first half, it was a pretty similar look on my face. Bearing in mind that I'd also dragged myself off my sick bed to watch that game and subsequently record this podcast.
Didn't make you feel better then?
It did not, no. As I said earlier, the the vomiting at 1 a.m. this morning has probably been the highlight of this day so far. So, yeah, less said about that all
you
the better.
You peaked early.
I did. Right. So we've talked about then the away day approach. We don't have a bit more to say on that. Oh, actually, I have got a question. Once again, we were all for Marco's free subs in the first half. They obviously had a positive bearing on the game, gave us some hope, some direction at the start of the second. At the same time, can we be slightly critical of the two he made later in the game? Did they take away any kind of momentum we had built up? Had we kind of given up the ghost?
Yeah, there was a hint of shutting up shop and thinking about Saturday, if I'm being really honest. I think it was producer Don who in the WhatsApp group immediately said, "Oh, are we trying to make sure Pellini doesn't get booked and miss important games?"
He's very concerned about his yellow card count. Very concerned.
Well, it's because the next ban is a big ban, right? And we've got some big games against sort of the kind of opponents where you need a Joao Pellini more than most. So I think there might have been a bit of that in there. To be honest, he wasn't playing that well, and I think we're allowed to say that about Pellini. He doesn't have to be perfect every game. Like, I sometimes say, he's our best player. You can't criticize him. Like, he is our best player, but sometimes he's not wonderful. And I don't think he was great tonight. So I think it made sense to pull him off, and Harrison Reed can do that job fine. Bobby Reed was a slightly interesting one. I thought, actually, I wanted to put a bit of praise in for Andres Pereira, who I thought was sort of probably among the most tenacious players in the first half when things were going badly, and probably amongst the most creative players in the second half when things were going a bit better. And I think when I saw him coming off for Bobby, I know Bobby's good for a goal from time to time, but I thought, well, I wonder if Marco is really thinking about Saturday. But, you know, we did get a goal. We should probably mention it on the pod. It was everyone's favourite centre-back, Tosin, who we all think is really good. But that ball in from Pereira was an absolute peach, wasn't it? I mean, I know people say he should do it more often, but he creates so many chances and he works very, very hard. And I do wonder if he sort of is somebody that Marco trusts to sort of enforce standards and keep things going, because we looked a lot worse after he left the pitch.
Yeah, Pereira's assist for Tosin's goal is the seventh time since he joined the club that he's assisted a goal from a set-piece situation. And I think in that time, only James Ward-Prowse has done that more. So, you know, he's very much a threat at dead balls. But as you say, I think he does offer so much, but often goes unnoticed as well.
Yeah, 100%. You know me, I'm in the Andreas fan club. Send me your hate mail, everyone.
Well, it does certainly seem to be him and the Tete Castagna seem to be the two blind spots for a lot of fans. Perhaps that will start to change after this evening. It's also quite amusing that, I mean, Tosin scored, he nearly got another, Tete hit the bar. Can you imagine if we'd actually clawed a 3-3 draw and those had been our goal scorers? It'd have been one of the most baffling games of all time.
I can't remember who said it in the Fulham Focus WhatsApp chat, which is, of course, the best place to digest a terrible night like tonight. But there was some suggestion that, oh, imagine if Tete gets the winner. And what I was saying was that, to be honest, he was left so far up the pitch because he wasn't tracking back quickly enough that he might have had a chance on the break. I mean, our right back was sort of constantly sort of stuck out there, almost goal hanging, as Callum Hudson-Odoi sped behind him. So, yeah, he might have nabbed a goal. I realise that I sound like I really hate Kenny Tete. Like, I sort of think as a personality and as a player last season, he was one of the best parts about Fulham Football Club. He's just not in a very good place at the moment. So sorry if I seem like I'm being very, very negative.
No, although it would have been very infuriating if he had scored a last-minute winner and then set off on a lap of honour, which was the quickest he'd moved all game. I felt like that's where it was headed. Yeah, I think let's draw a line under these two, let's say, interesting away performances at relegation fodder. And we'll move on to accounts and an upcoming game with Newcastle after this break. Fulham. Welcome back to Fulham Focus. Now, we're going to move away from depressing issues on the pitch to depressing issues off it. We've been eagerly awaiting the publishing of Fulham's accounts for a number of weeks, if eagerly is the right word. And today, the club released the following statement. Fulham Football Leisure Limited has announced its financial results for the year ended 30th of June 2023. The group generated turnover for the year of £182.3 million, up from £71.6 million, and the loss for the year was £26 million, down from £57.6 million. The increase in revenue and decrease in loss for the year is largely attributable to our 10th place finish in the Premier League last season. So the full figures have not yet been made their way onto the Companies House website, and we will undoubtedly cover those in detail with our resident financial expert, Tristan, when the time comes. But do we have any initial feelings on this news, chaps?
I'm just incredibly grateful that the extra money we've all paid for our season tickets has gone to such good use.
Yeah, so I mean, it seems like the upshot is we've made more money than ever before, we've spent more money than ever before, and we're still losing far more than we could ever hope to gain from any kind of ticket price hike, which really seems to be absolutely a drop in the ocean when compared to the rest of our income. Kish, do you, I mean, as a bit of an economics buff, do you have any thoughts?
No, other than that, it seems very, very expensive to be the owner of a Premier League football club, which is supposedly meant to be sort of one of the biggest money operating sort of things in the world. If I'm honest, I spend so much time thinking about how bad the economy is generally that I try to not depress myself with the economics of football too much. I would just say that £26 million as a loss, I think, is fine from a PSR FFP level. So I think that the first thing most fans think of when they look at accounts like this is, are we going to get done with the points deduction? My instinct is I think that looked fine, but I'll let better experts like Tristan come on and tell you all about that, and we need to see a bit more detail. I don't know if the Mitrovic money is reflected in these accounts, whether that's next year. Again, we'd need an expert to tell us that, but it does suggest that the general way that Fulham runs doesn't break even and doesn't make money, and that we're going to need to have a transfer profit if we're going to be able to make this sustainable in the long run, which I know is what the owners want and it's the way that the league's going in general. So I do think that, and again, maybe I'm too keen to defend players, fans were very, very upset at Alexander Mitrovic over the summer for good reason. it might be that when we look at accounts, and I think Tristan was explaining this to me last time I was on, we realised that he's done us a bit of a solid in terms of making everything look a lot better than it otherwise would. And I guess it sort of leads us to think about what the summer looks like in terms of outgoings and whether there are any players that we cash in on and sort of go again in terms of trying to identify the next players that we can grow and support the club. So yeah, that's about it from me. It's not an area of massive expertise, but I hope that made a bit of sense.
Yeah, well, Stuart, if there are players that we should look to cash in on at the right time in the summer, who would you envisage those being?
Unfortunately, I can't see Joao being with us for another season. I just can't see that happening. I know that we agreed, I think it was 65 million euros with Bayern late last summer. And at the time, I didn't feel like any amount would ever be enough for me to want to ever part with Joao because I love him so dearly. But I think if we can aim to get somewhere in that ballpark for him, it's a massive return on a £17 million investment, which is what I believe we spent on him. So unfortunately, I can't see him staying. He's too good for us. He's too good for a lot of clubs. He's too good for the likes of West Ham, who came in for him last summer. I can only really see a juggernaut come in for him, and him want to actually go to them. I can't see him wanting to go to a club fighting for a Europa League place. He's a Champions League player.
Yeah, I think the question with Polina is whether the things he's really good at are valued as highly by the best clubs as they are by us. And that's where I think maybe value in terms of what we think he's worth and what some of the best teams in the world think he's worth might differ a bit. But yeah, I think it makes sense. He's right up there. The one for me, I think, is I'd be quite convinced someone's going to come in for and we'll make a lot of money on is Anthony Robinson. Just because I think that, I mean, just look at England's struggles at left back. There aren't a huge number of left backs in the world who are excellent, and he's pretty good. And he does some things at an elite level, and he's an athlete at an elite level. He also, and touch wood, because there's still time left in the season, he seems to never be injured. I've never seen a player sort of sprint as much as Anthony Robinson and play as much as Anthony Robinson and never get injured. And when you look at sort of likes of Man United and Liverpool, who've had huge problems with injuries at left back, I do think that somebody will come in for him. Given what we got him for when he came in and the contract that he's been put on, I think that there's probably an opportunity to make a lot of money on someone like Jedi come summer.
And I guess, as disappointing it would be, but this would be the right time to cash in on him. Have we made errors in the transfer market in the past of not selling players at the right time? You obviously touched on Kenny Tete having interest last summer when he was doing well, now potentially heading out of contract. Have Fulham as a club, do they need to learn when to sell their players, their best players?
I think unfortunately so. It's never nice admitting that you need to sell these players because there are bigger clubs out there that these players are going to want to go to. It's never nice admitting that as a fan of a team. But unfortunately, yeah, I think we do need to start kind of wising up to the transfer market a bit more, really, and trying to, as you said, cash in on these players when the time is optimum. I wouldn't want to see him go in August. I don't think anybody would, but I can't see us turning down an offer upwards of 20, 25 million for him. I can't see that happening.
And I think we could get in excess of that for Robinson easily. So, yeah, and whenever you talk about money and stuff like this, you always get into the debate of sort of what are these rules supposed to do? And I know we're talking about the accounts, but it always sort of viewed with an eye in terms of financial fair play or PSO or the rest of it. I mean, as fans of a club like Fulham, it does feel like our existence sort of is to sell players to bigger teams who are loaded with way more debt than us, which just seems odd. Not my favourite topic, but it does feel like that there is something sort of slightly weird about the way that football's structured and the way that the money is all spread out. But that's sort of the way it is. And I think that at least we're in a position where some of our players are worth something and are desirable. That means that something's going right on the pitch. And long may that continue.
Yeah, we've mentioned Brighton before as having kind of that model and doing things the right way. And they announced today that they'd made a record £123 million profit, mainly thanks to Chelsea and their ridiculous transfer activity. So perhaps we need to start doing business with that lot down the road. And or perhaps not. Amanda Breuer.
I'd rather not. Yeah, we've paid them £4 million for a bloke who hasn't played 90 minutes, haven't we?
Not even been on the bench the last three games, has he? Missing in action. Do either of you want to say anything on the ticket prices?
No.
I would just like to actually just touch on the ticket prices quickly. So I was looking at the ticket prices for the upcoming Liverpool game, which are extraordinary. Charging £83, is it, for a junior in the Johnny Haynes stand, sit on a wooden seat behind a pillar. And I've gone past the point of being angry, and I actually got really sad because I'm now at an age where I'm taking my son to games for the first time. And as I pointed out earlier, we're mainly doing away games at the moment because it's a long way for us to travel. But I have a season ticket. To buy him an extra one and then pay for travel and, you know, everything that goes with a day out, it can't be done. It's just not manageable. And I can't be alone in this. And I really worry that a whole generation of new fans are going to end up being priced out. When I was growing up, I was one of like very few sort of like children, teenagers going to Fulham because we'd lost a whole generation of fans because we were so unsuccessful because we were in absolute doldrums during the late 80s. And I worry we're now going to lose a whole generation of fans because ultimately, we've been successful and we've got to the Premier League, and therefore the owners and the CEO believe they can charge these astronomical prices. So,
the thing I don't understand, though, is that no level of astronomical ticket pricing is going to make Fulham profitable, right? There is simply not enough seats in that stadium for you to charge an amount that's going to make Fulham profitable. So I don't really understand what the long-term gain of doing that is, other than sort of demonstrating, oh, we're sustainable, look, our revenue's going up, whatever. It's not going to solve this sort of a £26 million hole. So on a point of principle, I completely agree. But also on a point of practicality, I don't understand what squeezing fans and squeezing passionate fans out of the game really does as an owner, as a CEO of a business. If I'm being brutally honest, it just doesn't seem to make sense to me.
Surely you would look at the bigger picture and think that a ground full of passionate fans creating a better atmosphere, that, you know, the team have said they appreciate more, the management have said they appreciate more. Surely that's got to be the end goal rather than a sort of a very soulless atmosphere where it doesn't really inspire too much from, you know, what's going on the pitch.
We've just been talking about our away form. I mean, our home form is what's sustaining us in the league. I mean, it's not exactly a cauldron, Craven Cottage, right? I don't think it's sort of the sheer visceral sort of fear from opposition players.
Stuart
like
does
fans,
his best.
But there's Stuart aside, look, H5 is pretty lively from time to time. But like, that's where I sit. But, you know, I don't think that's sort of putting teams off and meaning that we're winning games. But home form is really important to us. If we'd have sort of flopped last season in the Premier League, we'd have been absolutely screwed financially. So there, you know, there is a balancing act to be done there, even if you're looking at it from the perspective of the sort of money men who are running football clubs. And I just don't think they're getting it right. Like, I don't think they're as smart as they think they are. Like, maybe they're as evil as we think they are, but I don't think they're as smart as they think they are, because it's really not that worthwhile.
They very rarely are. They very rarely are. I've seen Succession. I know what happens. Thankfully, we'll be back on home soil this weekend when we host Newcastle at the Cottage, although one glance at our recent record against them is enough to have us running for cover yet again. We've lost the last five meetings against them, no wins in eight, and our last three Premier League home games against them have ended 4-1, 2-0 and 4-0. Throw in January's cup defeat for good measure, and my question is this. Can we end this horrible run of games against Newcastle United on Saturday?
No. No, to put it quite simply, I've been a Fulham fan long enough to know that we don't really beat this team. I think the last time I can remember going into a game against Newcastle thinking we were going to win it was the Slav promotion season, where Ryan Sessegnon scored from outside the box at St James's Park. Every time I see that I've got to go to the cottage and watch Fulham play Newcastle, I immediately think, oh, I'll just stay in the pub. I'll just stay in the pub because that will be more pleasurable. They're nowhere near the side they were last season. They've got a load of injuries, players who would rather be betting than they would be playing. And I think that they are more fragile than last term. So our chances are better, but I don't know. It's just one of those bogey teams where you just get a bad feeling.
It does seem like that. It feels like the last three games we have let them off the hook. Like I thought the cup game was a great opportunity to beat them. Obviously the game up there this season where they had injury problems then, and then Raúl Jiménez gets sent off early on.
Yeah.
Last year, Nathaniel Chalabar ruining the game after 3 minutes. We just seem to ruin any opportunity we have. We sort of self-destruct.
Yeah.
Tell us about Newcastle then, Nish. What threat do they carry? Can we take advantage of this huge injury crisis that they have?
Yeah, so look, it's time to be positive. There's been too much negativity on the pod today. I know we never beat Newcastle, but if we're going to have a go at beating Newcastle, here are some reasons why this might be a good time to do it. They literally have no defenders. They have so
they
many
could have some of
injuries.
Ours.
They could have some of ours, and that would probably make them beatable. But as it stands, they're going to have to patch something up and chuck it out there. And that is sort of a reason to be cheerful. They're persisting with Dan Burn at left back. Could we start Adama up against him? Would that be fun? Would we like to see Dan Burn in the foot race with Adama Traore? I'd like to see that.
Could be good.
Stuart's coming in, yeah.
Yeah, what's happened to Matt Target?
He's injured.
He's a ghost, yeah.
Is he?
Yeah.
Okay. I feel so bad for him. He's the type of player, I know we were talking about Robinson potentially going in the summer. He's the type of player I'd be delighted if we signed for 5 to 10 million to come and replace him.
It'd be an option.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think they're really playing that much, even when he's fit at the moment, Target. He's really, he has fallen off the cliff. They sort of started playing Livermento off at left back or when Byrne wasn't there. But, you know, yeah, I every game afterwards, I put out an analysis thread online and someone says, should we start Adama next game? Because he looked really bright when he came on. And I always say, no, it's not sensible. He'll get injured. That's good as an impact sub. I mean, we've just been rubbish against Sheffield United and Nottingham Forest. Why don't we just chuck him up against Dan Burn and see what happens? That'll be fun. I'm going to the cottage. I'm taking my parents. I'd like to watch that. So why don't we give that a go? That'll cheer everyone up. Other reasons to be cheerful. Anthony Gordon can't play. He got sent off.
He'll be back. He served his suspension tonight.
Is that it?
Yeah.
He's done.
It was only two bookings, wasn't it, that he got sent off for?
Well, then that's rubbish. Then Anthony Gordon's back and we should all be terrified. And if he's not back, Harvey Barnes is playing anyway, and he's also really good, as is Alexander Isak. Basically, their front line's really good. Their defence is absolutely terrible. Goodness knows what either midfield will look like, given the way we've looked in the last couple of games. I sort of think it could be another bonkers game. And at this point of the season, we're safe. Let's be honest, we're not going to Europe. We never were going to Europe, but we know we're not going to get relegated unless there's something in the accounts that I really haven't noticed. So why not have an absolutely bonkers game at the cottage against Newcastle United and just see what happens? And I think that that is something that we can look forward to, because there are definitely goals to be had against this Newcastle side. You'd fancy us to net one. The question is whether we'll keep any out the other end.
Well, I think we do know the answer to that. So usually when we do these previews, we always end up asking, you know, what changes, if any, can we expect? I'm guessing the answer tonight is quite a few.
Hopefully, yeah. I mean, I immediately we chuck Castagna back in. I think he needs to be there, just for level headedness at the very least. I struggle when it comes to centre backs, because I know I've spoken about Tosin already. I also think Diop is also as prone to making potential goal threatening mistakes as well. So I don't know who I'd choose there. I think Calvin Bassey's a monster and I love him and I want him to be at the club for another 50 years.
Tim Remesque.
Robinson as well. Yeah. And I'd like to see, I know we were talking about the midfield earlier, I'd like to see us go back to Polina, Reed and Pereira. I don't think Lukic has done anything wrong. I think he's been very good since he came in. But as I was saying earlier, there's not been that cohesion since he's come in and earned a starting place. And I think we need to get back to that. So I'd like to see Reed come in and just do what he always does, which is put in maximum effort and throw his body on the line. And with regards to our starting lineup, obviously we're going for the new Ronaldo up front. Rodrigo, he's just
the old Ronaldo.
The new old Ronaldo. The new R9. I don't know what's happened to him, but I love it and I'm here for it. I think Iwobi, he'll have to come back in after only playing 30 minutes. And I think Willian's got the tendency sometimes to slow games down too much, I think. But I can't see anyone else that I'd rather start against Newcastle, because we need to have some form of control there, and that's what he'll bring.
Yeah, interesting you picked out Harrison Reed there. I wonder if we'll see Margot going back to Old Faithful there. We saw sort of this season's Old Faithful, which is Polina and Tom Kearney, which was what sort of sparked our renaissance and the 5-0s and me coming on the pod in the first place. So, you know, that would be going back to type this season. I wonder if he'll go back to what he did last season with Polina and Reed, just for that solidity. I have to think about that one, because I think that slot next to Joao is probably the most interesting one for Marco to ponder ahead of next week. Castagna definitely comes back in. I think he'll stick with Tosin and Bassi, just because I think, like you said, I don't think Issa Diop's much better.
Yeah,
and he likes that combination. And, you know, people get very worried about Willian's legs, because they sort of think he's about 80 rather than 35. But I know 35 is old for a football player. He'll be okay. I think he'll probably play. I sort of joked about putting Adama in from the start. I'm actually quite tempted. Who comes out to facilitate that, I don't really know. But I'll think about that in the week. By the way, just on Muniz, was quite interested watching back the Sheffield United game, having had the sort of knowledge that he was carrying an ankle knock. He does go down and grab it a lot. Like, I didn't notice it at all at the time because I was so wrapped up in our magnificent comeback. But I do wonder if he is carrying a bit of a knock. And I do wonder if we'll see a bit of Raul at some point now that he's back. But look, so long as he's fit to go, just chuck him out there. Because the thing that we can get from this season is working out just how good Rodrigo Muniz is. And I think we're starting to get the answer. We all like it. So I don't see why you'd like that.
Does he just not go down looking for free kicks and a bit of sympathy? Is it not kind of the sort of the Bukayo Saka style, I've been substituted, so I'm going to limp off and make it look like that's the reason?
Yeah, maybe. It was sort of, and maybe it is actually after he misses chances, he grabs his ankle and he's like, oh no, I would have put it at top bins if it wasn't for my ankle. Yeah, so that's the only sort of question mark for me up front, is just if he's fully fit or not. You know, two quick games in quick succession, he's played full 90s for both of them. But so long as he's good to go, chuck him back out, see what happens.
If the likes of Lukic, Wilson, and probably less likely Iwobi, if those players were not to start on Saturday, having been substituted so early today, you spoke earlier about you know, players are humans and we often forget that. Like, are they going to feel scapegoated in a certain way, or, you know, is that something that Marco will have to manage?
I think it's something that Marco would have to manage, and I think it's something he's entirely capable of doing as well. I mean, players are humans, as we were saying, but they're also adults and they should know that decisions have to be made, and sometimes they're not going to like them, sometimes they're not going to agree with them, but Marco's the boss. He's in charge, so you do what he says, and you come on and you give your best when he asks you and calls upon you. I think Marco's clued up and switched on enough to know how to manage that situation, and I'm sure that he'll be doing that to the best of his ability.
I think it's a tough one for Sasa Lukic in particular, just because I think one of the things you always felt was that it was quite clear that Marco didn't really trust him. And there was a breakthrough there. And I think the Spurs game was sort of the crowning glory of that breakthrough, as was United, actually, away. And you sort of hope that he doesn't go back to square one in terms of confidence in that relationship. But I agree, Stuart. I back Marco to manage that pretty well. I'm sort of, ironically, we were talking about the Riverside in terms of the accounts, and I've got Newcastle at the weekend. The only time I sat in the Riverside was for the cup game against Newcastle, where I sat behind Marco because I wanted to have a look at the dugouts. And I've never seen a manager look more frustrated at every time since Sasluke sort of slowly passed the ball backwards. And it was January, and I thought, there's absolutely no chance that he's sticking around. He's gone. And it turned around very quickly. And there was a time when I thought Adama Traore would never play because he was just eternally injured. And suddenly he looks like a really sort of potent weapon. And we were all convinced that Rodrigo Muniz was going to amount to nothing. Football changes really quickly. And, you know, I think all of those players can think that as quickly as things can go badly, things can go well as well. So, you know, if they keep the faith, I'm sure there'll be opportunities there, given the amount of football that's played now.
Yeah, I was just thinking, actually, before the game tonight, I took my son to football training. He's only 5 years old. And at one point, I had to pull him out of a game because he was being a bit of a dick. And he got very upset. And I thought, oh, how am I going to manage this situation? I've got a young player here in tears. Like, he's not happy with the way things are going. It turns out, big packet of Cadbury's chocolate fingers sorts them right out. So, Marco, if you're listening, little tip there from me to you. You can use that one. If you see Harry Wilson sitting in the dugout on Saturday with some chocolate fingers, you know where that's come from.
We know what's been happening, yeah, absolutely.
Right, let's hit me up with some predictions for this game then. What are we reckoning?
Well, I know I said that I think Newcastle are a bogey team for us. And then I was delighted to hear Kish talk, who's spoken me around. I'm going to go 1-1. Oh. I'm going 1-1.
Yeah, Kish started off very confidently, and then he realised that all these players are actually available.
I know. And I started off and maintained a horrible, horrible mindset on it. But I don't know. We're at the cottage. Anything can happen. I'm going 1-1.
Okay.
Either that or 0-5.
What do you reckon, Kish?
Well, look, I'm going to play this one tactically. So prior to the Spurs game, I thought we were going to get done by Tottenham. I thought that we'd score, but they'd score more. So let's do the same here. I think we'll get a goal against Newcastle. I don't trust them defensively at all, particularly away from home. So let's say 2-1 Newcastle. And then when it's 3-0 to us, you know that the magic still works.
I like it. I like your thinking. If you want to hear what I've got to say, I reckon we're in for another batshit mental afternoon. it could be anything from 2-5 to 3-2. I don't know. Let's go with a nice 2-2 draw. So that brings us to the end of a subdued, if ranty, Fulham Focus podcast. Thanks to Stuart and Kish for providing some much-needed therapy, and we hope we've given you some cause for optimism for the games ahead. If you've enjoyed what you've heard, tell your friends about us and hit us up on social media. Thanks for listening. We'll see you at the cottage soon.